You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 49, where we discuss the revised edition of Gideon Kunda's book, Engineering Culture, Control and Commitment in a High-Tech Corporation. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Ralph coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hello, this is Ella coming to you from Amsterdam.
Hi, this is Greta coming to you from Oxford.
This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Pedro coming to you from beautiful Lyon in one of the last days of summer.
Today we're discussing Gideon Kunda's Engineering Culture, Control and Commitment in a High-Tech Corporation. Overall, the book is an ethnography of the engineering division of a technology corporation, an examination of practical, scientifically informed, self-conscious attempts to design and manage culture. It sets out to explore, describe, and evaluate the reality behind the rhetoric of corporate culture. Chapter 1 provides an overview of the concept of culture and its dual nature, both rules that guide and shape behavior as well as experience of work, and means for influencing behavior and the experience of people in the organization. It previews one of the central questions, which is whether normative control by managers is a form of tyranny or a movement of liberation. Chapter 2 is a general overview of the company, tech, and its engineering division, its history, employee population, structure, and some of the relevant practices and policies that underlie the engineering of culture. Chapter 3 describes the substance and form of the managerial ideology of tech culture, and tech's engineering division in particular, and it addresses a number of questions. What images of the company and then of the various kinds of members are embedded in the culture? What does the right mindset mean, which the managers often discuss? What does getting the religion consist of, which is frequently mentioned? And what kind of member role do the culture designers have in mind, and how is it represented? Chapter 4 describes and analyzes the actual practice through which the culture is brought to life and the ideology made meaningful, how cultural engineering occurs in everyday life in the organization. Chapter 5 documents the forms of experience that are shaped under the cultural spotlight and in the shadows of its darker side. That's one of my favorite terms, the darker side of culture. What kind of people are created? Ooh, that sounds like Frankenstein. Real or false selves and create themselves in the continuing experiential transactions that underlie normative control. Chapter 6 is the conclusion and provides an overview of the main findings and attempts to analyze their moral implications. And the book also includes an appendix which offers a personal and very subjective description, according to the author, of the history of the research project, the methods used, and some of the concerns and potential biases, both personal and cultural. So, what do people think?
I think that's a very good summary of how the book is built up, and I actually really enjoyed this setup of the book, and I think it's a very powerful example, this book, of what ethnography can show, what it can bring to light in the context of management and organization studies. Especially like the what was in the background of my mind while reading was this, the social construction of reality, the intended social construction and maybe the unintended consequences of it. And I think that was very well illustrated in this book. And I think putting this book in perspective, like the research being done in 1986 and the book first being published, what year was it? 1992. I think it was very novel at that time. And I'd love to have a discussion about like how we see these things play out in organizations nowadays.
Yeah, Greta, I totally agree. And when I first started reading it, I thought, this is so familiar. The discussions, the descriptions
I thought the same thing.
Yeah?
Yes, this was, yeah, it was so familiar, absolutely.
It just seems like it could be today. I mean, it blew my mind that he was describing a high-tech company, but where the internet was not really a thing yet. And yet the way that they were behaving, interacting, their priorities, the way they were talking, it just seemed like any high-tech company today. It was maybe a few less signs of play, so they weren't emphasizing pool tables or video games or anything. But they did mention people playing cards in the cafeteria and open plan offices, and the entire environment just seemed very familiar. So I agree that it seems like it's still very relevant. And throughout, I also noticed this underlying theoretical analysis of the social construction of reality, and specifically Kunder is drawing on Goffman mainly as analytical input. Irving Goffman, the sociologist who drew on the theater metaphor for understanding everyday life. And Goffman has this notion of defining reality and who gets to define a situation and who gets to define what is going on at any time. And it really does seem to be an analysis of the struggle that goes on in this organization, where these different parties, management, the engineers who are very high status in the company, and then those who are somewhat peripheral to that, competing to define the situation of reality. Like, what is it to work in this place? What does it mean to be a full member of this organization?
And I would also add that it was good to see Kunde described kind of how the organization got to where it is, what its roots were as a very small engineer firm where people knew each other perhaps a little bit better, certainly a lot differently than the snapshot that were presented in the majority of the book. But you can also kind of see how the engineering culture grew out of the growth of the company from its rather humble beginnings to what was at stake in 1987. And that really painted a picture in my mind about how the growth of the company, it couldn't grapple with it. And what we're seeing is a lot of the results of some challenges it faced as it grew into into a larger company.
Yeah, that's right. They sort of had this problem that companies are facing today. They started as a little startup and were enormously successful, but then they've grown to a huge organization. And so they're dealing with that scale-up problem. And then how do you maintain control of your workers while you want to keep this kind of, we're so cool and innovative and we don't have formal structures. And then culture really comes up as the solution. So they're managing through culture rather than through an organizational structure.
And all the while convincing themselves that they haven't changed.
Yeah, that's right.
I was also kind of struck by the lionization of Sam Miller. That was a big part of the way that the organization expressed its culture was through sort of an idealized presentation of its leaders. I was particularly compelled by it because that's sort of at the level I'm accustomed to have worked in my past, is to see how, for example, the leader is I don't want to say used, perhaps employed is a better word, is sort of employed as a self-styled figurehead whose symbolic leadership and actual leadership are almost divorced from each other.
Right. It reminded me of the symbology of the heroic leader, right? Which you see in mythology
exactly.
And other cultures. And I spent almost 30 years in the Navy, and our rough equivalent was descriptions of Admiral Rickover. So we would often tell these stories about Rickover did this, or Rickover did that, or Rickover intended this. And you just grow up listening to people say things like that. And then as I got more senior in the Navy, I thought it was kind of puzzling that they still refer to those kinds of things that Rickover wrote, or they'll have these things he wrote the 1950s. So that is a major part of the culture in the nuclear power field of the Navy, is these descriptions of the heroic leader.
And Ralph, how explicitly is that passed on to you when you're new? Do you have these sort of training sessions where you're shown videos and you read speeches, or how is it passed on?
And that's a great question. It's a little bit of all of those, or both of those things. It's you get some of the things that he wrote and speeches that he gave. You get transcripts of those things to read about them. We'll talk about decisions that he made early in the program, and so you'll hear these through stories of people. And when I came into the Navy, there were people who had actually been interviewed by him. He was forcibly retired in 1982, but there were people that I knew who had been interviewed by him, so they would tell stories of what the interviews were like as a way of describing the culture that he was looking for. And many times you never really knew whether it was something that really happened or somebody just kind of made up a story. But there's this famous example of an admiral who, before he was admiral, he was getting interviewed by Rick Roberts in Admiral Zumwalt's biography On Watch. And he described, Zumwalt was a little pretentious and pompous, and Rickover had absolutely no patience for people like that. So he got thrown in a broom closet, I think, not thrown, but, you know, had to go back and sit in a broom closet and meditate, I think at least two times when he was getting interviewed for a job at Naval Reactors. And that's one of these stories about what Rickover would do that people would tell as a way of describing his imprint or what kind of features he was looking for in leadership.
When reading the book, I think what's interesting, I don't know if it was designed this way or just the way I read it, it seemed almost that we start in a journey in which Kunda show us this corporation that he calls Tech and how it has tried to engineer exactly a specific ideology, a form of culture that works as a form of control. And what was interesting is that in the book, he starts after a general introduction of the issue of culture and organizational culture in specific, presents a general overview of the company. And it starts by showcasing what is somehow the official, the party line, what is the main ideas associated with this culture. And as we go chapter by chapter, I see more and more space to the individual somehow, to the possibilities of resisting or at least distancing of what is perceived as the official culture that is trying to be imposed on the individual. So it is, I had that feeling as I went through in the narrative that there is this tension in the book between what is the company trying to inculcate on the individual, and we see what are the interstices, the space that exist of different perspectives and different positions and takes on this attempt.
So to build upon what Pedro said, I agree that it's very interesting to position this book in its time, and especially especially in the popular managerial literature on culture at that time and where that came from. And at that time, we're talking about the 80s and 90s. That was the boom of Japanese management. And as a new approach to management, this was like after the World War II, we saw the rise of Japanese organizations. And people found it remarkable how they recovered after the war so far and tried so fast and tried to explain what were the underlying reasons for this success. And they said that this is about the culture of Japanese organizations, and we should learn about it. And especially Peters and Waterman and Deal and Kennedy, the books they wrote have been highly influential of how these ideas about organizational culture as developed in Japan were translated to the context of the American corporation. And I think this book is almost like a snapshot of that period of time, how these ideas got picked up and how they got implemented in a corporation and the effects it has. Yeah,
and I think one thing that that has also kind of struck me is that because he's looking at a new industry, I mean, the technology industry was basically growing at that particular point in time, is that people were available who had an understanding of how the culture was formed in the first place, as opposed to, say, an older or more entrenched firm where the culture is so deeply, so understood that even the members might not be in the same position to analyze it themselves or be able to offer insights as to why are we doing things this way.
I totally agree with you, Tom. And I think especially in the technology industry, there was this reflection on, okay, as we grow, how do we want our organization to look like and how do we want to manage it and seeing the potential to do it differently. What I found interesting is how kind of this case also shows the pitfalls of how, like, culture management, engineering culture was picked up in US corporations, as that it was seen as kind of the antidote to bureaucracy, to hierarchy, to structure. And instead of managing the structure, they focused on managing the cognitions and the ideas and the behavior of the people. So they didn't have to do it as kind of resolving the problems of bureaucracy. Well, when you focus on Japanese firms, bureaucracy has always remained there. So culture and bureaucracy went hand in hand. It was never an opposition.
Yeah, I think building on what you said, Greta, is that it was a way to look at both these ideas of control, right, through bureaucracy and rules and the scientific management approach, right, which comes up more than once in the article, and shifting towards these rules or guidelines to shape behavior and experience of the members, which is something it's hard to imagine Taylor going down that path. He was more about control and follow these rules. And it seems to me that when you talk about the Japanese influence, right, it was more about how do you get people to believe in the organization? And this, I think, is one attempt, and there's other ways to do this, I presume, to graft that kind of Japanese approach onto American values. And what I really think is interesting about the approach Kunda took was he also looks at this darker side. How does this attempt to influence people's emotions and how they perceive reality, that social construction of reality that Ella and Greta mentioned, does that translate into other problems for people, or is it a, and then he talks about whether it's a continuum or a continual balance. That's what I thought was a key insight from the book, that it's not you're not some place in the continuum that stays put. It's a continual balance that you have to strike all the time. And it seemed like a lot of work for some people.
I really enjoyed that part because he places this whole conversation in a wider context of the human relations movement and how work started to become much more about the social aspects of being together in the workplace, and that historically we previously had other institutions that we belonged to and that gave us a sense of self and a sense of community, but that increasingly that had been shifting into the workplace with the organization as the site of belonging, as your source of a sense of family, and that this company, Tech, is really manipulating that and making use of it to get more out of its employees. So by getting them really engaged and very strongly identified with the organization, they start to see their own future and the organization's future as one and the same. And this idea that in becoming a member of that very strong culture, you are not straightforwardly for it or against it, I thought was a really nice nuanced take on the situation, because it's easy to say that they're far too identified. But he draws on Goffman to say that as a member of these sort of institutions, we take up a position somewhere between identification with an organization and opposition to it. So we're ready at the slightest pressure to regain balance by shifting involvement in either direction. I thought that was very insightful.
I agree. And I think he showed very vividly this dynamic between what he calls role embracing and role distancing, especially in the chapter on the self. I think that was chapter 4 or chapter 5.
Yeah. Chapter 5, yeah. Self and organization.
Sorry to be a party blooper, but can we... I want to rewind a bit back to the text. I think we are, you know, spiraling a bit out.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what I wanted to say is, I think it's important that we take a moment to discuss and think about why was Kunda writing this book? You know, what is the place of this book in the overall literature? And more specifically, why a book on culture? You know, nowadays it's kind of a old school fashion. We know that times has almost passed. But I think that's something very interesting in the book. And it is, as we were saying, still very timely. From what I understand, this book stems out of Kunda's PhD thesis. And he was interested in understanding culture. And back in the day, it was still a very central concept.
Well, Pedro, I was very interested in hearing your view on that, especially this statement at that time that managing the company culture can be like the antidote to all the bad sides of bureaucracy, to put it bluntly.
Right, particularly because you're looking to shift the locus of control from overseers and supervisors to the actual employee themselves through self-discipline and use that term, a feeling in your gut or buy into their religion. And that way there's this expectation of management that people will be autonomous or more autonomous and therefore pursue the work with more zeal and more dedication. And I thought sometimes Kunda overemphasized the dark side as if that was strictly coming from the normative control. I mean, I think there are probably aspects of that, but if you see many of the quotes in chapter 5, when he's talking about role distancing, the engineers were saying this happens at all organizations, or I saw this before, or they were a little cynical because it's not something that was unique to tech, and therefore I'm unsure that it was really part of the normative control, although I'm sure it's probably connected. But I think some of that, the aspects of the pace of the work and focus on profits and getting bigger are natural, built in many organizations.
Well, what I wonder is to what extent were the engineers feeling a rare opportunity or a special opportunity to vent, which was how I took some of their some of that chapter. And so I'm sure that he probably had quite a lot of that type of reaction or that type of data available to him. So, you know, it probably is, you know, indeed he shows examples of how engineers manipulated their environment in order to present that they were in some way resistant to the ideology. But even still, I had a sense that this was because of perhaps the comfort that Kunda had in being able to navigate the organization, that they were very willing to open up to him and perhaps tell him things that made it into that chapter that they might not have said or done elsewhere.
Yeah, it goes back to the social construction of reality and the fact that the ethnographer actually impacts the environment he's observing, which Kunda admits. And I got that same sense, Tom, that there was some venting going on. And he actually says in the book, and I don't remember, it's in the epilogue or chapter 6, where he says that people were asking him for feedback. You know, they'd give some pronouncement or some comment and ask him to give feedback, which I've always felt uncomfortable with as a researcher, when people wanted to ask my opinion of what their answer was, because I was concerned that it would influence what they would say after that. And Kunda says he actually gave his opinion on more than one occasion.
Yeah, but I thought he did by laying that out in the, I'm pretty sure it was the appendix, that by laying all that out though, so it helps to, you know, frame the context of the points he's making. And because he did include this, notes about the setting and which was really fascinating in some parts, like how some parts of the organization were setting up their cubicles in mazes. I'm sure I'm getting that description sideways.
Yes, I read that as well.
Yeah,
yes.
as a way of trying to, you know, little small forms of resistance. It was just kind of funny.
But to add to that point, it might be that some of the quotes and some of the interviews and conversations he had with people was really for them to vent. But I always say there's a reason for them to share this information with a researcher. And I think it does very vividly show, like, what this company tries to do is, instead of like directly managing the work of the people, they rely on people managing their own work and peer control, like controlling others, to create this kind of big brother setting where he talks about in big words. And the role of management is to manage the culture and manage the thoughts and ideas of people. And you kind of see what the consequences of that are in terms of like the micro sociological environment that's being created in this company and what that does with the people. So I think the venting is definitely an expression of that the people there felt worth sharing.
Greta said what I wanted to say in a better way. I don't know if you already mentioned that, but I think what really strikes me, and you know, and I think that the book is very smart in a way, is that Kunda was aware of all this discussion that existed about organizational culture and how it was hailed as the solution for all kinds of ills and the thing that companies had to invest on. And he finds a company that is really invested on using culture as a mechanism for control, as a way to, you know, lead to productivity, motivation, so on and so forth. And he does what he says, you know, the analysis of, a cultural analysis of culture. And I think that's what lays, you know, of the interesting thing, which is trying to go beyond just what is being discussed. He finds a setting in which the problem of culture is very transparent, that it is seen everywhere. It is in the discussions in the corridors. It is in the stickers in the cars. And he tries to go beyond to what all these things say and see how are they shaping or not individuals? How are there space for resistance? You know, it's a very kind of a smart idea that I really appreciate in trying to almost do like a double analysis at the same time of what is being said that is being branded as the local culture and going beyond to see how is that culture being culturally forced upon or resisted.
I thought it was summarized really nicely, this whole notion at the beginning where they're no longer managing sweat, they're managing souls. I found that very evocative. And there is this tension, though, where it comes across sometimes as if everyone's left to their own devices and this is an environment in which you can self-actualize and really drive your own career. But then the formal mechanisms of control are constantly kicking back in terms of people being taken off projects or getting unfunded, which is as close to getting fired as you can get in this environment, which has a no layoff policy, which I found fascinating. And so people are kind of constantly conscious of being hung out to dry and being kind of put in the corner. Even if they're nominally still in the organization, there's very formalized ways of making sure that they recognize their own insignificance within the structure of the organization. So it's kind of this interplay of people being left to interpret this normative control themselves, but also feeling the force of the organization at key points in their career.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe this is something we can like get to the next part, but I studied for my PhD a company similar to tech, which was, you know, an aeronautical company, so the technological context is very much there. But one thing that was very different for me and from the account that I read in Kunda is that all this conflict that you're saying is like really this impression that each department is like fighting each other to death and they really have their own products and there is no sense of cohesion. And it's something that was very, you know, I mean, almost difficult to read and imagine the life of these people and this company that is completely, you know, pulling all sorts of directions and people are all kind of skeptical to each other. You know, it's, well...
He mentions in the appendix that some of the feedback he got from the few people who read the study when it was finished was why the skepticism? And it does come across, there's this sort of critical tone throughout. But I agree, Pedro, I really wanted to know what are these people actually up to? What is the nature of their work? And he admits, again, in the confessional add-on to the book, that he's not really very interested in the technical aspects of their work. He's not particularly interested in the technology that they're developing. And so he doesn't really go into the details of what they're doing. And all that's left is this posturing and presentations and a lot of drama. But you don't get a sense of what it is that they're passionate about, which is this, well, undefined character in the book of their actual work.
Right, or whether they're making products that are insanely great, as some people would describe, right? Because I think he, to make the corporation anonymous, he had to make all those things about the products generic. And so the engineers do talk about the amazing work they do and how they think they're doing great things for the customers. But it falls flat, I think, when you make it that, you know, that generic, because then you really can't relate, as you've already said, which I thought was unfortunate. So I don't know if he's cynical or doesn't like the company, or that's a consequence of him having to focus on these generic things they do and then getting in the details of the cynicism and the squabbles. So one of the things that stuck out to me, Pedro, and I don't know if it's similar to what you observed, I noticed that there's lots of conflict that goes on, and I understand the burnout and the alcoholism and difficult family relations when you have this kind of stress at work, because I've seen it in other kinds of work. It just seemed interesting to me that they had this finger pointing and people had these really strong conversations, and then they would often be summed up, well, let's take this offline or what have you. And that struck me a bit, is that many times there was this open conflict or even people expressing this emotional open distance. Maybe I'm not saying that right. Openly expressing the emotional distance, like the engineer, this one just floored me. The engineer who went, I think, to the culture training, I think that was the session he was describing, and went through a couple of days, and then they had handed out certificates for attendance. And some people would put these up, and the one engineer wouldn't take it. And they tried a couple times to offer it to him, and finally got him to take it. And then right in front of the person who handed it to him, I don't know how many people were in the room, he tore it up and threw it away.
I just wanted to pick up on this notion that we got all of these really engaging stories of conflict at work, which I agree was quite flooring to read some of these interactions that were going on in this company. And then the kind of lack of detail about the actual engineering work that they were doing. And I agree there's probably some sensitivity issues there, but it's also pointing to a bigger issue as work leaves the factories and really becomes more about computer work, which has only gone further in that direction since this book was published. How do you do an ethnography of someone typing away on a computer? I mean, that's what these engineers are doing. A lot of them are coding, programming. It's not very exciting to watch that kind of work. So then what becomes more engaging if you're sitting around for a year or two with these workers is to go to the rituals, the presentations, the meetings, the big conflicts. But I feel like we're lacking as ethnographers or as researchers a way to really highlight the substantive parts of what they're all doing all day. So this is a challenge that I'm also dealing with in trying to study knowledge work.
So that's a great observation, Ella. And on that note, I suggest we'll wrap up here part one of episode 49, and we'll explore some of those ideas and more in part two. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we continue discussing Gideon Kunda's engineering culture, here on Talking About Organizations.